Welcome to the NSCHBC Edge Podcast, leading the way in the business of medicine. Now here's your host, Terry Fletcher.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the NSCHBC Edge Podcast. I'm your host, Terry Fletcher. The Edge Podcast is brought to you today by the National Society of Certified Healthcare Business Consultants. Our goal is to discuss healthy business principles, have conversations on the business side of medicine, so that you and your practice can thrive and be profitable and successful for years to come. As many of you know, the NSCHBC is a proactive organization with over 300 members, including legacy members, that share their wealth of knowledge and expertise with each other, whether it be in the legal field, the accounting field, the RCM field, the business management field, value-based care, and more. We have every kind of consultant that focuses on the healthcare industry that you could want. So for this episode, I'm happy to welcome back fellow NSCHBC member and healthcare business consultant, David Zetter of Zetter Healthcare. Hi, David. Welcome back to the podcast.
Morning, Terry. Thank you.
Yeah, it's good to have you here today. So today actually could be probably our mission statement. We're really looking at protecting the private practice physician or even dentist and their reimbursement efforts because of the ever-changing climate of payers, fee schedules, whether it be Medicare, Medicaid, or even commercial plans. Before we get started, I wanted to set the stage. I found something interesting within MGMA and AMA. It said more than 100,000 doctors have left private practice, become employees of hospitals and other corporate entities since 2019, and almost 3 in 4 physicians are employees of larger healthcare entities instead of being independent, mainly because of costs with labor, rent, premiums, malpractice, all that. And I think we're trying to really protect that independent practice physician, you know, even though the Medicare reimbursement rates haven't kept pace with inflation and, you know, we've got higher operational costs. I think one thing that's missed in all of this as we talk about money is the front desk collections and not just staffing, but making sure that everyone's sharing in the expense of the encounter and the visit and the services. So I'm going to start there. I'd like to start with a new patient. You know, when a patient calls for an appointment, what happens? I mean, I've seen a problem here just in even going to the doctor's office myself. So start there for me. What do you tell your clients?
Well, it's what I would love to do is be able to be there when they're setting everything up so that we can set it up properly. But yes, front desk is very important. You've got a lot of people there that are dealing with patients, and there's revenue that's either being missed or, you know, potential revenue that can be collected at that point in time. But what I tell people is basically, you know, there are many things and duties and responsibilities that are responsible with the front desk. It depends on where you're placing those duties and responsibilities and who they are with, and how you communicate those duties and responsibilities. So no different than what you said, when somebody, you know, if somebody's calling and wants to schedule their initial appointment, create that patient physician relationship, that's where it starts, is with that, either that phone call or when the patient walks in off the street. And once they request that appointment, at that point, all demographics should be collected correctly. Because obviously, you know, as well as I do, you have one transposed number on an ID card or insurance information, or even if you type in Bill Smith versus William Smith, that claim is going to get denied. So there's lost revenue right there. So the key is proper training of individuals so that they can actually collect that revenue, submit a claim properly, and make sure that they have all correct information. So it's incumbent upon anybody that's collecting demographics to collect it correctly, validate it, verify it, double check it. And you're better off taking the extra time at that moment to verify everything is absolutely accurate. All spelling is correct, addresses, you name it. Because it's going to take a heck of a lot more time to correct that on the back end than it would if you just spent a few extra minutes on the front end and verified everything was accurate. So right, that would be the first thing.
I found something interesting. My daughter just made an appointment for, and she was, she's always like, "Mom, does this sound right?" And I'm like, "Well, what happened?" And even kids in their 20s are like, it's funny because they just don't seem to understand how the real world works sometimes. But she says they asked me for a deposit to go to the doctor. And I'm like,
Oh,
"Really?"
yeah.
She says they wanted $100, but said it will go against whatever I owe when I come in, but I have insurance, so. What do you think about that?
Oh, I tend to agree with that, especially in light of today's environment.
Yeah.
You can't, so you have to, one, first look at your state laws, look at the payer contracts that you have. In most cases, this can be done if it's done properly. And you can either have a reservation fee, kind of similar to, in some cases, like on OpenTable, where you're reserving a place at your favorite restaurant. If you don't show up, they charge, some of them charge you a fee for failing to show up and taking up their table. Well, the same would go no different. Everybody in a medical practice normally has a no-show fee, or, if you don't cancel in a certain period of time, they'll charge you a certain amount for that failed appointment. So having a reservation fee for an appointment isn't bad as long as you apply it to the copay. Or deductible or whatever they have to pay. You cannot collect more than what they're going to owe. So if you collect a fee of 100, and let's say the services are only going to be 75 that day, you need to give that $25 back to that patient that day while the patient's there. You can't hold that credit because every state has escheatment laws that require you to not hold credit balances and pay that back to the patient. Otherwise, it needs to be reported to the state, Secretary of State or Treasury Department, and they take care of making sure that money gets back to the patient if you can't locate them. But there are many rules and laws, and you got to make sure that anything you're going to implement complies with those rules and laws so you don't go down another road that's going to cost you more money.
Well, you made a statement that I think is interesting for our listeners, and I come across this all the time. And that is, everyone always seems to think that Medicare is the only rule out there. And they don't realize that when it comes to especially collecting out of pockets, you need to go not just to your state, which is the first thing. Then you have to look at payer policies. Now we've got the No Surprise Act. There's so many components, and Medicare isn't even on the radar with some of this stuff.
That is true. That is true. But Medicare usually sets the stage for all
They
the
do, yeah.
initial regulations and guidelines. So that would be where I would start. And then the next place I'd go is to the state, look at your contracts, look at provider manuals with each payer. I mean, as I've always said, those who hold the gold make the rules. Every insurance company makes their own rules.
Right. Now I have a question on patients who say, "Well, I don't have a credit card or debit card." Well, first, I want to go, "Sure you don't," but I'll be nice. I'm
Yeah,
politically
that's a
correct.
bunch of baloney.
I know. What do you do with patients that, let's say that, my daughter called in and she said, "Well, I don't have a credit card." What can you deny access for patients that won't give a deposit? Just, I
Well,
want to
no,
make sure they
not
don't do
really.
that.
So, like if a
Okay.
patient is presenting with an acute problem and they're already, they've already, you have already secured that patient-physician relationship, meaning they've already either been to your practice before. You scheduled an appointment. If they're calling for the first time, you can refuse treatment. That's not an issue. If they walk in off the street the very first time, you don't have a relationship with that patient, you can refuse treatment. If you have a relationship with that patient, they have an acute problem, you can never turn that
Yeah.
patient away because then that's patient abandonment. And
Right.
every state has requirements on how you properly discharge or communicate with a patient. So the key there would be is that if they're presenting, and I've always provided everybody with this script. If a patient shows up and they say they don't have their wallet, they don't have a credit card, direct them, first of all, know exactly where your nearest ATMs are and direct them to the ATM and let them know, look, we collect payment at the time of service. Your contract with your insurer and our contract with your insurer require you to pay at the time of service. It requires us to collect at the time of service. Do you really want us to get in trouble and then have to close our doors because we violate and breach our contract? You
Right.
put it back on the patient, what are they going to do? Tell you, yes, we want you to violate the
Yeah.
contract?
Right.
I mean, it's very easy. Put it back on the patient and make them deal with it.
Right. And I think one thing's missed too is that a lot of people train people on the computer. They train for the revenue cycle management department, back office, but they forget to train their front desk
yes.
staff. see that so much.
Speaking of training, yeah. That's all about. So how many practices provide continuing ed for their staff or train them the proper way?
Right.
It's kind of no different. Most doctors that I talk to in startups, they're going to say they're going to hire front desk person. And I said, okay, that's great. Do you know what their responsibilities are? Do you know what they're supposed to do, in what order they're supposed to do it, and how they're supposed to properly do it? Inevitably, every physician says, no, not really. Then my comment is, how are you going to interview them? How are you going to train them? And how are you going to make sure your practice collects every penny it's supposed to? If you don't know how to do it, how are you going to know it's being done right?
That's true. That's true. And that's why I always recommend, you know, either bring somebody from the outside in or make sure that you've got some kind of, you know, compliance plan or training situation going on there. Otherwise, it's and everybody's on the same page, especially if you have a multiple physician practice where, you know, you have to collect evenly, you know, out of pocket share of costs. You can't say, well, one doctor doesn't collect their copays and this doctor does, because patients talk, especially in the waiting room, and they share that information.
Well, I mean, nowadays, every EOB that comes out is, you know, communicating if you believe you've been a victim of fraud
or anything else. Right.
I mean, just the mention of a patient not having a copay collected or, you know, oh, we're going to collect your copay, we're not going to bill your insurance. I mean, you do one, you've got to do both. If you don't do one, you can't do either.
Right.
I mean,
that's
it's just
a good
the way the law
it.
Is.
Yeah. That's a good way to put it. So, okay, let's say the patient got in, they're now an established patient, and let's just pretend the world's perfect and they have credit card and that's on file. So how does that work as far as for example, and this actually scared me on an audit I did recently. I said, I just need the claim form and the encounter documentation so I can just make sure what you build is supportive of what you documented. Well, they also sent me the patient's intake sheet, which I didn't ask for, but I noticed that patient's credit card number was on there. And they're,
I know.
Oh, I was like, no, I don't want that. But
PCI compliance.
Yeah. So where does that information have to be kept safe? And should it be on their intake form and for how long?
No, it should never be anywhere. So what I do, no different than what we do with our clients, because we require them to maintain a debit or credit card on file. And the law states that when you collect a debit or credit card or anything that you're utilizing to achieve payment from a patient, what you're supposed to do is you have them sign an authorization form. The authorization form should only have the last four digits of the credit card or debit card number so that you can at least identify the card that they're using. That can be retained, just the last four digits. When you accept that debit or credit card, it should be swiped into your merchant services system. If you're going to do a merchant services system and have credit card on file, the system should be able to retain patient account information in the software so that you don't have to swipe a card each time. So you swipe the card, let the financial company or vendor maintain that information. Do not risk your entire livelihood on keeping a form with a full credit card, even locked up in a filing cabinet. That is illegal. It's against federal regulations. So have the system keep that information. Then all your staff has to do is when on a monthly basis, when you're going to go charge everybody's credit card on balances that are due, then you go ahead and process it. Or you even have systems out there nowadays that are automated and you can just set up a monthly payment. You have an authorization form, patient authorizes how much you can charge to their card each month, and set it up so it's automated so that you don't even have to have staff go in and do it. On whatever date that you set it up for, the system will automatically bill all those patients. In some cases, some of these systems will even send notification to the patient on what was billed, what it was for, and the balance left on their account. This way, you don't have to send statements out to patients. You're not wasting time, money, and postage. Because let's face it, how many times do you send a statement to patients? Most people say three. I always ask, where did that number come from?
I know,
it's
me
an old
too.
Wives' tale. There's no law that says you have to send any statement to any patient.
Yeah.
But you need to communicate when you are collecting from them, and that's the best way of doing it. So there are many, technology has changed, and there are a lot of systems and vendors out there that will get all this done, relieve a lot of pain and headaches from the practice, and make it much more efficient and ensure that you collect every penny that's due to the practice.
Now, I've seen that obviously airlines have gone cashless if you want to buy anything on, you know, food or drink or anything. And I've seen some practices have done the same, but some of them still haven't. So for example, I can't believe this happened to me. I went into the doctor's office just for a well check, you know, whatever. And, you know, $20 copay, happened to have a $20 bill handed to him. She handed me a receipt. I didn't even look at it, folded it up, put it in my purse, went on my way. I got a statement the next month for my $20. I'm like, wait, I already paid that. I pulled out the receipt. The receipt said zero. So they handed me a paper receipt that didn't log the payment. And I'm just like, you've got to be kidding me. So of course I got
into
my portal.
How much you want to bet that was embezzled?
I know. So I got in the portal, mentioned it to whoever I said, you know, billing, whatever. And they said, oh, send us a copy of the receipt. I said, okay, so just so you know, this says zero, but why would somebody hand me a receipt that didn't have any money attached to it? I was ready to go to war. I was so unhappy about that. And I'm like, you'd mess with the wrong person. And it was kind of funny because within 2 days she goes, we found it. No worries. It's been adjusted. And I'm thinking either you didn't find it and that person got in major trouble or you just said, let's not even go there. But cash is a problem. If I ever find embezzling, it's usually cash at the front desk.
Well, that's going to be taken care of for us. And why I say that is because cash is going to go away.
Yeah.
There will be no coins and paper dollars in our foreseeable future. All governments are going to digital currency. It's a fact. There are many countries that have already done this. The U.S. is already preparing to go that route. So eventually all of our wallets are going to be completely empty.
Yeah.
So
I still think it
behooves everybody to make those changes now because it is coming.
Yeah. Well, even when, you know, yesterday going to get my McDonald's coffee out of the drive-thru and I see somebody in front of me giving cash, I go, that was weird. And she goes, it's really weird because we constantly get alerts from the head office saying that, you know, watch $5 and $20 bills. They're the worst. I'm just like, really? She goes, oh yeah. So just for people out there that, you know, if you do still take cash, just if you're listening to the podcast, you need to make sure that somebody at your front desk, whoever's responsible, that there's a way to track it. There's a way, you know, that you're paying attention. Otherwise that can be definitely a problem. Well, going into cash apps. Okay, so this is something that's come up in the last couple of years. So, you know, Venmo, you know, Cash App, Trail, whatever. They actually encourage that you tell everybody about it. So, you know, when I get a manicure or pedicure or whatever, you know, I pay with Venmo and you can pick private or it goes to everybody that's, I guess, in your phone and that's
right.
Also signed up for it. Well, those aren't HIPAA entities, and there's
Correct.
A problem there because if somebody goes to the doctor's office, they don't want somebody else to know, and they made a payment, and you accept that Cash App, can't you be responsible if you didn't warn them to?
Nope.
Okay.
Because they're the ones that are a patient. It's no different than a patient emailing the practice. They initiate a communication, and I'll just use a real funky example.
Okay.
You've got a person with HIV. They're emailing their doctor about their condition, their diagnosis. They initiated that email. For some reason, they got the doctor's email, the practice's email. They initiated that communication. Nothing wrong. The patient can do any darn thing they want. You reply, now you're in trouble.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
Okay. So in a Cash App, if they want to share with the world that they paid, you know, the oncology practice, some money, or, you know, no matter what it is, an OBGYN practice, and nobody knows they're pregnant. I mean, it doesn't matter. Somebody puts two and two together, a friend, because they noticed that, you know, I reported that I made a payment to a doctor and I went to this specialist and they figure it out. That's my problem, not the doctor's.
Okay. Even if they accept the app.
Well, if they accept an app, sure. Why not? I mean, that's okay. Still the patient is the one initiating it. I don't recommend those kind of apps. I mean, Zealous,
I know.
Zealous is fraught with all kinds of problems.
Yeah.
And so yet there are insurance companies using that platform.
Yeah.
I'm not so sure I would be using a lot of these platforms to be paying bills. You'd be better off putting a credit card on file with the practice versus using one of those cash apps.
Yeah,
in my opinion.
I agree. No, I agree. It's just so invasive, I guess is the word that I would say. You know, everybody can see what you're doing, so it's better to keep it private. So one thing that I think is really actually improved, you know, not to keep going down what could be negative, but to in the positive, you know, you and I have been doing this a very long time. And I remember when the only way to pay your doctor was through, you know, writing a check when you get that paper statement. But not just cash apps, but now we've got our portal. So now we can sign into our account on their EMR or through their management system, and we can now pay that way. Do you recommend to practices to have every possible way to take a payment or to limit it to just a few?
Well, I would, first of all, if you're going to be successful in private practice, you want to make it as easy as possible to obtain payment. My personal opinion would be obtain every possible access point in order for payments to be received, but vet every one of them. So, you know, if I'm going to use a cash pay app, for instance, I would probably use Venmo over a couple of others because they've had issues. Everything is hackable. I think Change Healthcare and the government has pretty much proved that. So there is no way you're going to protect information. Not in the world that we live in today.
Right.
So with that said, I'd vet whatever measure or vendor or, you know, tool resource you're going to utilize in order to obtain payment. Do your research and make decisions that way. And the minute you find out there are some issues, you've got to address it. No different than, you know, you find out there was an error on collecting demographic information. What should you do? Go back to the person that collected it and start training them better. So the minute you find out that there's an issue with anything, address that issue and resolve it, mitigate that risk.
Now, do you assist in your business people to, do you write up policies so that they know how to follow them where they can, you know, share that with staffing where you have written policies on
Absolutely.
Front desk? And
okay. I've got a whole operations manual that is a boilerplate policy and procedure manual. We take that. So just had a client last week that hired a couple of MAs for the front desk area. We gave them the whole front desk financial chapter. They're editing it so that it work. So in other words, the policy is a boilerplate, but you've got to go in and change that policy and word it in the manner that you're actually operating. It communicates exactly how to, like even on charge entry, it's going to communicate the name of the software they're using. It's going to say, give descriptions of the screen, where to enter stuff. That way, when you pull that policy out, you can hand it to a brand new employee. They can utilize it bullet point by bullet point. They'll go down, and as they follow that policy and procedure, they're doing everything exactly the way it was intended to do. That way, Susie isn't training Vicky all her bad habits.
Yeah. Now, how do you tell this a practice, and this seems to be a sticking point with some practices I deal with sometimes, to collect the copay on the way in, not on the way out?
I agree with that. You should be collecting money before they see the physician. Otherwise, they'll walk out of the practice and you're going to collect that checkout and they say, oh, well, I don't have my purse with me today. Again, the same thing. We've heard it a million times.
Don't
You're giving them the opportunity to walk away without payment. That is on you. That is not on the patient. Build your policies and procedures, enforce them, make very few exceptions. I realize there are exceptions to every rule, but they should be very few and far between. If you set a policy, no different than you require a patient that if they fail to show for an appointment, you're charging them, you know, the $100, $150 fee, whatever it is, make it hurt. Otherwise, it's not going to affect anything.
Right.
And make sure you have a way to collect that money, even on a new patient. So if you don't require a credit card on file, how are you going to ever collect that no-show fee? It's never going to happen because the patient probably won't ever show up again.
Right. No, that's very true. Now, when you're talking about these duties and making sure that everyone knows what they're supposed to do, what is your opinion, professional opinion, when it comes to who posts payment, who opens the mail, because things do still come through the mail, versus charge entry, things like that? I know a lot of people do different things, but it concerns me when I see the person opening the mail who also enters checks.
Well, that's, I call that no different than the notes I sent you this morning, separation of duties, checks and balances.
Yeah.
So you've got somebody doing the charge entry, somebody pays a $20 copay. So that person should be, usually they're at the computer. They can put that payment in the system. They can also document it. So I require every one of our clients that we set up a practice, we do daily reconciliation. So you print out, and some of this is old school. You print out a schedule for the day. As every patient shows up that day, if there are no show, you write no show on the schedule. If they pay a copay, you write down on that little printout that they paid their $20 copay, and you write it out that they paid in cash, check, or credit card. Then you should have the receipt or the actual document. If it's a chart, if it's a credit card slip, put a copy of that with it. If it's a check, it should be placed in the envelope. If it's cash, it gets placed in an envelope. At the end of the day, you validate and check. Somebody reconciles that schedule validated every payment received. Now that schedule gets handed to somebody else to make out the deposit. Again, separation of duties. So you got somebody at the front desk collecting everything. You've got to verify all of it. And then somebody has to measure and validate and provide oversight. So make sure that all those payments were entered into the system. At least do a spot check. Because if you're not measuring it and providing oversight, there, you are not managing your business. So yeah, you've got to measure and provide oversight and validate that it was done. And then on that daily reconciliation, that sheet, all the payments, all the slips should match what the deposit is. Somebody else should be taking the deposit to the bank. And then all of that gets attached together and saved, and it should all match. It should match your QuickBooks or whatever you're keeping your accounting system in. And then at the end of the week, everything should balance to the penny. At the end of the month, everything should balance to the penny. If you're not doing daily, weekly, and monthly reconciliations, then you're not really running a business. You're running a hobby.
Right. No, that's true. And, you know, just for our listeners, just so you know, David and I are making these recommendations and giving you this insight, not because we're, you know, we distrust your staff. It's because we don't want you to invite risk that you can mitigate before it even happens. So basically, it's kind of like, you know, balancing your checkbook, doing your own household accounting, and making sure that you're not, you know, I hate for it to say this, but, you know, it would be just like laying cash around your house, you know, and you got teenagers around. They won't take it if they know, you know, what's good for them. But if it's laying around, it's sitting there in their face. It's like saying, you know, I dare you. So let's not do that. Let's make sure that, you know, there are the checks and balances, that you do have that separation of duties, so that there is oversight. And that's what that is. It's making sure that people are accountable for what they're doing, not just in the front desk, but anything that has to do with your money. Because again, going back to what I said at the beginning, you know, unfortunately, reimbursement rates have declined when you look at inflation and everything, and expenses have increased for physicians. And so there has to be a way to make sure that not only are you getting your insurance money, but that you're also collecting that share of costs, because it's a joint effort when it comes to getting paid for what you do. It's not just coming from the insurance. And I think that's a misnomer that a lot of providers and a lot of practices think. They're like, what can I bill to insurance? Okay, great. But remember, there's typically a share of cost, especially post-pandemic. Remember, you know, they gave us some flexibility and some things during the public health emergency that you didn't have to collect out of pockets, but that's gone away. That's no longer there. That was almost a year ago that's ended. So it's really important that not only do you listen to David, but you have these policies in place on how your workflows are going to happen, how you're going to make sure that everyone is on the same page. And one of the things, and I'll kind of wrap it up with this, David, how do you talk to practices or educate them on the multiple physician practice, making sure that everyone does this, you know, or is consistent at least in how they collect, so that there is not the leakage and the holes and the people not understanding, you know, well, this doctor wants this, because that can be a problem.
Well, you know, when you got, so if you do have, you know, multiple owners and partners and things like that, first of all, you've got to get consensus from leadership on what the policy is going to be. You can't have every physician running their own policies in the practice. It doesn't work. It's never worked. It's not going to work in that manner. You know, you've got to have consistent policies. Otherwise, it's kind of no different. You know, when I say you're hiring people for the front desk, I recommend to clients, you hire MAs for every low-level position. That way you can cross-train them. Somebody that's triaging a patient can also go do front desk, can also do checkout. So that's the first thing. That way you can have everybody that understands, knows, and is cross-trained. And when you're short-handed, you've got somebody that can step in and fill in for that missing person. But
it's a great idea. I never thought of an MA at the front. That's a great idea.
Oh, absolutely. We hire MAs for every single position. That's front desk, checkout, you name it. Triaging, whatever the case. MAs are the lowest level. We don't hire front desk receptionists, because what are you going to do when the receptionist doesn't show up and you've got MAs that are working the patients and nobody can run the front desk, or vice versa? So it's best to make sure everybody's cross-trained. But in addition to that, you've got to make sure that people are trained properly. You've got policies and procedures. You provide them education and make sure that everything is consistent. Consistently hold meetings when you have policies and procedures that leadership has agreed to. And again, the first thing will be is have a board meeting, have an ownership meeting, and get everybody to come to an agreement on what the procedure or the policy will be. You have to do that first, because if you've got five different physicians with three different ways that they want things done, your practice will not be successful. Because no. Now you've got, let's say Dr. Smith has somebody that triages his patients, and all of a sudden that MA is gone. Now he needs somebody to fill in for him, and you're going to utilize a couple of the other MAs that work with other physicians that are used to doing it one way, and now Dr. Smith wants it done another way, and he's not going to be happy. Get everybody to do everything consistently. That way, when you're trying to provide oversight and measure whether everything's being done right, you're not looking at all these different rules to figure it out. You've got one set of rules. Everybody follows the same rules.
Oh, that's a great idea. I'm actually going to steal your idea on the MA thing. I just have this big light bulb over my head. I love it. So we haven't even thought of that. Usually we think, you know, front desk reception, front desk personality. But you're right. How many times do they say, okay, just pull the front desk, you know, gal or guy, and we'll just make it work. And I think that's a tough way to do things. So
on top of that, you know, the difference between a cost of an MA and like just somebody that's a receptionist or front desk person, I mean, you're talking about maybe $2 to $4 to $5 an hour.
Yeah.
Think about if you hire an MA, one, they're already trained to deal with patients. In many cases, they'll be able to draw blood. They'll be able to triage them. You can train them on the front desk, even if they haven't done clerical work before. You can train them to do everything. And, you know, even in our job descriptions, it's got clerical and clinical responsibilities. And that way, all of your MAs could literally fill in at any position at any point in time.
Which, that's just genius. I love that. That's a great way to end it. And I hope everyone takes that advice. I know I will, because I think that's great to take to my clients. All right, everyone. Thank you again, David. We really appreciate you being here. And this is some great information.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure to do it, and willing to do it anytime.
To find and contact David Zetter, you can go to NSCHBC website at nschbc.org and click on Find a Consultant. Type in his first name, David, or his last name, Zetter, and this information will appear. Also a reminder, the nschbc.org website offers monthly free webinars on a variety of topics, as well as a quarterly Medicare regulatory update. Please go to nschbc.org, click on the tab Upcoming Education. I'll be presenting the first quarter Medicare update webinar on March 26th. Also, registration is now open for our annual conference. Again, go to nschbc.org to review the agenda and speakers. That's it for us today, everyone. Make it a great day and a great rest of your month. And thank you for listening to the award-winning NSCHBC Edge podcast. I'm your host, Terry Fletcher.
Thank you for listening to the NSCHBC Edge podcast. Join us on the second Tuesday of each month as our consultants tackle the complexities of navigating the business of medicine. You can reach us on the web at nschbc.org, the National Society of Certified Healthcare Business Consultants.